Tarek Reese is the author of the Lean Startup book, which has since become almost gospel in the startup world. We have a great chat about writing, career strategy, how his philosophy spans different verticals, and how it's adjusted in the years since writing. Check it out. Also, Eric's book, Leader's Guide, was also a first selection for the Product Hunt Book Club. Stay tuned for a lot more about Product Hunt books. All right, here's Eric. When would you say was the first inkling of what would become a lean startup?
When I was an engineer and a technical founder, I had a lot of pretty wacky ideas about, you know, how products should be built, how teams should be organized. And I had this problem. It was a serious problem, especially when I became founder of InVue and started to have people work for me, and we'd have investors in the company, and people would send their like technical due diligence guy from the VC firm over, you know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. And, you know, this, it wasn't in the days when you just be like, oh, we just do AWS and everything standard. Like, you had to build your own server, you know,
right. You'd
build your own colo facilities and you had to do it. I mean, it was a lot of architecture and technical process that needed to be vetted because it wasn't standard how things were done. And I had this problem. The company was super productive by normal metrics. So, like, a lot of people thought I was some kind of super genius, and we cranked out software, you know, faster than anybody thought possible. We got all these great business results. People loved the results, but then they wanted to know, well, how come it works? Like, how do you do it? And I'd be like, hey, I'm not a super genius. I have these ideas about rapid iteration, customer centric, you know, split testing, which at that time was very controversial, and product development, continuous deployment, all that kind of stuff. And people would be like, that doesn't work. What you're talking about is crazy. Like, that can't possibly work. And I would be like, no, come over here and look at the evidence. Like, let me show you that it does work. And one thing I learned the hard way is that people who like are, you know, long veterans of the software industry, they do not want to be shown evidence that their like precious thing that they've learned all their whole career is like not the best way, especially from some kid who they didn't never heard of before. You know, it was rough. So I was really looking for, how do I explain this to people? Mm-hmm. Here's a story most people don't know. Steve Blank was one of our investors at InVue, and he was on our board. So I was really into his customer development theory. I thought his book was great, and we tried to explain that to most VCs, and they didn't know who Steve Blank was, and they didn't think his ideas were considered quite crazy himself those days. But we finally found a VC who's like, oh yeah, Steve, we really like his thing, and we were like, we're going to totally nail this pitch. You know, they're going to definitely want to invest because like we have Steve's stamp of approval. And they were like, okay, so yeah, totally want to do it the Steve Blank way. So like, where are your market requirement documents? A lot of your listeners probably don't even know what an MRD is, PRD. These were these like formal documentation systems that used to be considered like standard for startups to do as part of their development process. Now it's like seems laughably primitive, but this was, it's only 2005, 2006. I'm not talking about antiquity here. This is 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I remember telling Steve about it, and he was so mad because, you know, people were like asking for that in his name. And he was like, no, they're not getting it because we all have the same problem, which is we're trying to show people a new way and people didn't want to see the new way. Anyway, at a certain point, I was like reading every book I could get my hands on to just be like, where can I find something to help me understand this? And I tried so many different metaphors. Lean Startup was not the first one I tried. I used to have this like elaborate analogy that had to do with cell biology and mitosis and meiosis. I was a dork and nobody got it. No one understood it. I was like, and the nucleus of the cell is this and that.
What was it going to be called?
I mean, this was before anything had a name. I was just like, literally, the problem was, okay, we were like going through very fast growth. We're hiring a lot of engineers. So like, I just needed to have a way to explain to new people, here's how we do work around here. How's that work?
It's mitosis.
Yeah, it was bad. It was a really bad plan. Do not recommend. Anyway, so I did not get it right a lot. I tested and iterated myself a lot on the concepts. Anyway, I found this really helpful set of books about lean manufacturing, and I was finally like, oh, now I understand. There were a bunch of techniques, like continuous deployment, that I could see worked. I knew intuitively they were the right way to go, but I didn't know why. It was a mystery even to me why they worked, because the engineering systems that I had been taught, like my formal schooling and the, like what I had been learned as an apprentice in my career, told me it's not gonna work. But I could see that it did work. And so I just had to be like, you know, when people work for me, it was fine. I could be like, listen, with all due respect, you work for me. So try it, you might like it. And, you know, not everybody would, but like, you know, eventually most people, I would wear them down. I'd be like, you gotta try it. And people would try it, and they would be like, hey, this is pretty good.
Yeah.
But if you try to talk to investors and VCs and outside people, you can't just, they don't work for you. So you can't, right. They're just like, nope, not gonna try it, not interested. So when I had the kind of conceptual breakthrough to take some ideas from lean manufacturing, of course, Steve's customer development, and a guy named Colonel John Boyd's OODA loop, for those that come from a military background, there's a couple of key ideas that came together in my head. This is, you know, in 2005, 2006, 2007. That was like a huge, like, intellectual relief for me to be like, oh, okay, now I understand what I'm doing and why, like, I got it. But at that time, I wasn't like coining phrases and trying to convince people. I wasn't blogging about it. There was right. no, I was just like personally very excited about it. I just assumed, I was so naive. I assumed at that point that I was just rediscovering something that other people knew. But in those days, there weren't a lot of startup blogs. There wasn't a lot of information about this kind of stuff out there. So I just figured it was like secret knowledge that I had like gotten myself into. And it was only later when I started writing about it and trying to teach people the system that I realized, oh my God, maybe it's possible that nobody knows the answers to these questions and I'm on new terrain. And that was both like kind of exciting, but also very scary.
Yeah. The Lean Startup came out when?
The book came out in 2011.
And has become, you know, part of and you know any seminal startup kind of education.
Well, thank you for saying.
You've done that. What do you do after that? What's next?
I ask myself this question all the time. I never thought I would be doing this. So like, people always ask me about the future. I'm like, I don't even understand the past. Certainly don't understand the present. I definitely can't predict the future here. Well, two things happened when the book was published. One, much more than I ever dreamed possible, the ideas really crossed over into the mainstream. Now, that's why you write a book. That's why you smear ink on dead trees and go through the traditional publishing process and, you know, become a New York Times bestseller. Like, I was not like naive about that. Yeah. I understood that there's a certain set of people in this world that are causing a lot of the problems that need to be fixed that don't read blogs. So you blog, you're the world's greatest blogger, and they're not going to read your work. They consume information in a very specific way, and it's easy to understand. Imagine you work for a Fortune 500 CEO, and you're like, boss, I really think we need to take this idea seriously. I'm going to put something in your hand. I'd like you to take it with you on a plane. You know, and when you're on your private plane going to whatever, like, I'd like you to read this. We could print out a bunch of blog posts and hand it to your boss. Like, that's not going to happen. But you can say, there's a book. It's a New York Times bestseller. It's got all kinds of people that you recognize blurbing it on the back. Like, this is legit. Check it out. Mm-hmm. So that is the, like, that gets you in the door. Now, the book actually has to be good to persuade these important people, you know, to give what you're describing a chance. But in order to even get the opportunity for your ideas to do battle on that field, you have to do all this preparatory work to make that exchange possible. So that has really happened a lot with the Lean Startup. And so a lot of my work the last 5 years has really been taking these ideas into new and unusual places where, you know, we're talking about some of the world's largest companies, big bureaucratic organizations like the United States government, and just like, for me, like really wild products, you know, hardware, energy, healthcare, drilling. I mean, I go on and on about like the really wacky stuff. I got a call from an entrepreneur who wants to save the American bison. You know, do I even know what an American bison was at the time he called me? Absolutely not. But, you know, that's been the Lean Startup ideas applied in a lot of new ideas. So that's been super cool. And then the second thing that's happened is a lot of the companies that were early adopters of Lean Startup are today hyper growth, post product market fit, you know, pre-IPO exciting companies. So there's all these people who were Lean Startup fans when they were like, three guys in a garage, mm-hmm. and now run these massive companies, or, you know, are involved in the leadership of 1,000, 5,000, 10,000 person companies. And when I was first talking about Lean Startup, even going back to 2008, I was trying to explain to people that we need to have a comprehensive system, to the question you asked before, that this is a management system that is designed for situations of high uncertainty, which is what entrepreneurship is characterized as. A lot of people who first adopted Lean Startup were kind of like, yeah, management system, it sounds fine, but like, let's talk about MVPs, you know, like, let's talk about the thing I need to talk about right now. So a lot of those same leaders have, like, later, as our company's gone larger, been like, hey, what was that management thing you're talking about? Because they have this like new set of problems, which is like, now that they've built this new big company, they're starting to notice many of the same big company problems that they became an entrepreneur to avoid in the first place. So I have this kind of dual existence where I get to work with these really big companies and bureaucratic organizations and these new hyper-growth companies kind of almost on the same day. I'll do both. And here's the cool part, the thing that nobody really believes. A lot of the problems are the same. when you build your new company to an old school 20th century blueprint of functional silos and people getting promoted and, you know, performance reviews, like, it's all the old system, you get the old results no matter how young your company is. And so kind of what am I doing next? Like, next for me is trying to convince people that we need to focus on not just how do you get your company started, but what kind of company are we trying to build in the first place? And how do we build a company that's like a truly modern company where every person's creativity and energy is well used, where the energy of our employees is diverted away from politics and towards serving customers, and where we can seek out new sources of growth through continuous innovation and not just exploiting that one good idea we had that one time.
And have you chosen this path as kind of an advisor? What capacity are you best helping companies? You know, there could be like a company builder thing you start. There could be, you know, you could start a venture fund or work at a venture fund.
Yeah, I've certainly explored a number of those things. I have a lot of different relationships with companies, sometimes as an investor, sometimes as an advisor. Some companies engage me as a consultant. A lot of companies just bring me in as a speaker, and we'll kind of have an informal relationship where they kind of diffuse the ideas into the company. This is the funny thing about startups is every startup wants to be unique. So no startup really wants to say, hey, we're just doing that other guy's idea and doing it well. Most of us want to say, like, we're do things the X way, where X is, the Google way, we're doing the Facebook way. Like, we want to have our own thing. So I'm actually very happy with that. I'm very happy for these ideas to be incorporated into the company's DNA, and then for the person who brought them in from the outside to be kind of forgotten. Yeah. Because that's actually good for the company culture and good for the kind of sense of morale and kind of internal cohesiveness that the company has. You know, it's kind of weird to have an outsider telling you what to do.
When you're writing this book and 2010, 2009, or you lead up to it. Knowing what you know now, what would you tell yourself then?
I haven't gone back and reread The Lean Startup recently. I think it would kill me to do so. It's painful to see.
And why is that? It was a great book. People loved it.
Of course, I am so thrilled. I'm beyond thrilled with the positive reception it's received and the kind things people say to me about it. Whenever I speak, I actually did a European tour recently, and I was in London and Amsterdam, and people were coming up to me to tell me about how the book impacted their lives. And I mean, it was like people traveled from across Europe to go to these events. I met people who were in places in the world I couldn't find on a map with my, substandard American public education. Mm-hmm. And yet, The Lean Startup reached them, and they had something kind to say about how it had. So, like, that's a wonderful experience. When it's your thing, you see the flaws and the defects more than anybody. Yeah. I mean, I was like thinking a lot about it coming over to Product Hunt, because it's like when you launch something, from the outside, it can seem like you got everything figured out and it's all perfect and everything. But when you're on the inside, man, you know all the problems. So, like, when I had to read the Lean Startup for the audiobook, it was a torturous experience, because you're sitting there in a studio. I had to do it over 3 days straight, like morning till night, reading in the studio. It's at a stage in the publication process where you can't make any changes to the manuscript. You're reading what's already been written, and you're having to read it out loud, which is a technique that people use to like improve their sentence structure and find bad writing. Mm-hmm. Like, you read something out loud, you often be like, "Ooh, that's bad phrasing." So, like, reading the whole manuscript, every word out loud, you're just constantly like, "Oh no, what was I thinking? Who wrote this garbage?" Like, why? And you're like, "I gotta go fix it," but it's too late. It's out there. That's what it is to publish a book. That's why I haven't read the book recently. But here's a thing that I wasn't that concerned about then, I'm much more concerned about now, which is, if you are putting an idea out there into the culture and someone misunderstands it and they go off and do something wrong, who's responsible for that? Like, you have an ethical responsibility as an author for what happens when people actually read your ideas. Now, in some ways, that's like crazy. Like, you'd be crazy to take that on. It's been a recent controversy about Clay Christensen's theory of disruptive innovation. Clay is a wonderful man, very kind, brilliant thinker. His books have been so positive and so influential in so many places. There was a bunch of documents that came out in the Samsung Apple trial from a couple years ago. You could see like various places where Steve Jobs himself was making notes about Clay Christensen's ideas in his like presentation. So like influential at the highest levels of the technology world. Anyway, there was like a backlash about disruption, and like people are sick of hearing about it, and it was like a takedown in some magazine, and it was preposterous. It was basically saying that because there's a bunch of people who have never read Clay's work, who have like misappropriated it, misunderstand it, like going around slapping the word disruption and all kinds of things that have nothing to do with disruption, like he's somehow responsible for that. And at first I was like mad, and I'm like, you know, want to defend him and say that's not right and you shouldn't say that. And but the more I think about it, the more I'm like, well, and of course this is personal for me because people misunderstand Lean Startup all the time. I get complaints, especially from VCs, about people who are like, hey, someone pitched me this thing they said was Lean Startup, but it seems like garbage to me, like what's going on? The more I think about it, the more I think as an author, as an evangelist for an idea, you do have a responsibility for what happens. You can't, of course, control what people do, and you're not, I mean, if somebody says that Lean Startup told them to like go create their company and do something awful, like I don't think I'm morally or legally responsible for that, but my responsibility is to try to make everything I say as clear as possible so that people will not misunderstand and will be able to get a positive result. And when I started to think about that, I started to realize, wait a minute, the way that most business books are written is not really living up to an ethical standard that I think is appropriate. Because here's the thing, you think about famous person X, like there's a trend now for famous entrepreneurs and investors to write books and give you their life advice. And they used to be considered weird, but now it's a very popular thing to do. So they're telling you things that work for them. And the assumption is if you do what they did, it will work for you too. And let's grant that that's true, although I think a lot of cases that's pretty suspect to begin with. But even if it's true, it doesn't necessarily follow that them writing it down in a book and then you reading that book, interpreting what they say and trying it will work for you. It's actually a pretty big leap of faith. There's a lot of room for error, misconceptions. And so until you've really tested that out, how do you really know that your book is making the world a better place? And even if it's making the world a better place on average, that could mean that two people, for every, you know, every three people that did it, two people had a great experience, but one person like went crazy because they made a mistake based on something that you said. So I especially like what I'm thinking about now is much more, what does it mean to actually treat a book like a startup and hold it to the same ethical and quality standards that you would a startup, which is to say, it's not good enough to just build a product, put it out there, and be like, well, I hope it makes people's lives better. Like, no, you have to measure and test and build your MVPs and do the experiments to make sure that when your ideas are put into practice by people who learned about them from a book, that they actually are better off than they were before. And so I'm trying to hold myself to that standard in my new work.
It's interesting, I mean, because you've been doing this for over a decade, but you're only 36. I say only to the extent that you could do a lot of things. You could build another platform, you could invest, you could speak, you could write, you could teach, you could do, I know it's tough, but there's, you know, a long time horizon, what you want to focus on and what you enjoy most and how you can make the biggest impact.
You already laid out the criteria, you know? When Lean Startup was very young, I did it all. You know, I spoke and traveled and I was like, it was like retail. I was trying to convince people one at a time, and I worked with companies, and I did a ton of just like trying to get people to give the ideas a chance. I wanted to be every company's advisor, and I wanted to be invested in every company. I wanted to like just have the, I would do all this stuff. And then at a certain point, the community took over. And now for every kind of Lean Startup practitioner, there's like people writing about that and blogging about it. And there's like 15 books now that have been written, you know, that are in some ways derivative of Lean Startup. And there's a lot of people building companies, consulting companies on top of Lean Startup. There's a lot of people building tools and platforms and every kind of thing. There's people using Lean Startup in their investment companies. And at a certain point, I realized, wait a minute, I don't have to push this boulder up the hill anymore. It's got a life of its own, and I'm not pushing alone. There's actually a lot of other people pushing it. And they're actually better at that than I am. It really forced me to say, well, what am I actually really good at? Am I a great networker? Not really. Am I a great community builder? No, I'm not the best at that kind of stuff. Am I the best public speaker? Am I the best consultant? Like, I don't think so. And so if the community doesn't need me to be doing those things, why am I doing it? And a lot of it is because of my ego. You know, I'm like, well, I want to be the guy doing it. I was like, wait, no, that's not the right thing. I got to think about what's the contribution I can make to the community. And I think that's where, you know, I come back to the writing and the like formulation of the ideas and the packaging and, you know, dissemination of these critical few concepts that are high leverage, high impact. Like, I think that that's something I'm actually good at. And we need more of that, you know? So I'm like, okay, there's a need there that's not getting filled and that I can have a positive impact with. And when I compare, so then I'm like, okay, so I could do that, or like I've been asked on many occasions to join a VC firm, you know, sometimes under very lucrative and, you know, very prestigious terms. And I'm like, maybe I'd be an okay investor. I don't know. I don't think I would be very good at it. I don't really enjoy the work that VCs do. I admire it. The people who are good at it, I mean, it's a combination of the personal service that they offer to entrepreneurs, the insight about the industry, the ability to evaluate deals, you know, like all the stuff that goes into being a great VC. Like, I admire the people that can do that. I don't think I would be very good at it. And I certainly don't think I would enjoy it very much. It's too, culture of VC is not for me.
I wonder if there's a role where you just do what you do, but be aligned with it. Where a firm would just want you.
I mean, that has been proposed to me under a number of circumstances, but like, I don't want to go to partner meetings.
Yeah.
I don't, right now, like, one of the greatest things about my job is I don't have to have meetings with anybody. So I have the, like, a true luxury in this world, which is to have freedom to pursue the work that I want to pursue when I want to pursue it under whatever terms I decide. I'm not accountable to anybody. I don't spend other people's money. So that's all really nice. You know, I feel like that gives me a level of autonomy and the both like public credibility and the actual intellectual autonomy, the actual independence required to say things that are unpopular. And this is the thing people forget about Lean Startup. Like, now people, guys, Lean Startup has come so far that it's now considered contrarian to criticize it, which I think is hysterical. Yeah. That's true in Silicon Valley. In the broader mainstream of business, we're in the first inning.
Yeah.
You know, we're practically in the first pitch of this battle. This is a long-term effort to convince people that the old ways of working don't apply anymore. When I first started talking about Lean Startup, it was not popular. It was very controversial, and a number of people told me to stop talking about it in no uncertain terms. You know, it was not. It didn't go very well at the beginning. Mm. It was rough and rocky. And sometimes I think I have a next set of things to say, and not all of them are going to be popular and fun. Like the Lean Startup slogans have become, you know, like there's like a new set of things that need to be done, and the only way to be truly independent, the only way to have that, to have people really be able to accept that, is to be independent and say, like, yeah, if I piss off the elite VC firms again, so be it.
What do you have to say today that's unpopular?
Well, first of all, a lot of Lean Startup is still unpopular, and we have a real disagreement still about how much of entrepreneurship is kind of the great man having the right kind of, like, I don't even know how to put it exactly, but there's like a certain ineffable charisma and genius and determination.
Yeah.
How much of that is really what makes entrepreneurship work versus the actual work of the people that work in the company? You know, like, is it about the man and his underlings, or is it about creating a system of people working together to create a common goal? Now, most of the people that really believe in the great man theory, they don't come out and say it. So we're not having a very public debate, but privately behind the scenes in many VC firms especially, I know this is a debate that's happening, and there's a lot of pretty famous people who are not on the Lean Startup side of things. In terms of like new things that are unpopular, I'll give you one example. A lot of founders that I talk to, they eventually get to have enough success in their career with their company. They get to a stage where if they're being really honest, which they never would be in public, but if they're being really honest, they would say, now that this company is 500 or 1,000 employees, I'm not sure I would even really want to work here.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I could even get hired here if I wasn't already the founder. Now, don't get me wrong. Being the founder CEO of a high growth multi-billion dollar, like, it's a pretty sweet gig, so I'm not complaining. It's pretty fun. But like, is this actually the kind of company I would want to work at as a regular employee? Not really.
Yeah.
Now, I'm naming any name, not saying any particular person said that to me, but I see that in the private thoughts of a lot of founders. And they get frustrated because they see people who work for them not acting like entrepreneurs. They're acting like company people, and they're risk averse, and you know, that whole stuff. And it's just like, here's the unpopular advice. I talk to them a lot about this. Like, that's your fault. A lot of founders think they're the victim of this. Like, somebody did this to them. It's like, no. Not only did you make bad decisions in how you set the company up that you're now paying for, but you are right now, as we speak, causing these very behaviors that you oppose. You say you want people to act innovative, but actually you've set up a system that would punish them if they did. And that is not a popular
right.
thing, especially because if you believe in the great man theory, you know, the founder just needs to like have their ineffable founder juice like rub off on everybody, and that will get everybody to be faster. Or the peons don't really have anything to contribute, so that what they need is better micromanagement from the superstar. And like, that's where these ideas, like, they go from the realm of like abstract philosophical debates to like real consequential choices that people make that affect real people's lives. And so to be cavalier about it, you know, I think is poor form.
I have this one friend who uses the concept in kind of even among friend of MVP, but applied to his personal life. When meeting, you know, potential co-founder, for example, doing a hackathon with him, or on a potential date, he'll spend like hours at a time with this person to really see early on. Have you, maybe it's a silly question, but have you thought about, or have people come to you with this concept of like MVP as applied to, you know, their personal life or things outside of work?
I get asked about it pretty regularly, actually. And there's like a lean dating.
Is there?
People are talking about, I am boycotting that whole conversation.
Interesting.
I don't want to have anything to do with it. I don't know anything about it. You know, I recently became a father and I was like, this is not lean parenting. Okay. I'm not going to be experimenting with my child. Like that's, I don't know. I don't have anything to say about that. It's too far afield for me.
What books or things have you not done yet that you know you want to?
Oh man, I have so many things I would like to do. I mean, the big project that I'm working on aside from Lean Startup is something called the Long-Term Stock Exchange, the LTSE, which is an effort to reform the public markets and get companies and investors thinking in a more long-term way. That's a complicated and hairy project, which we don't have to necessarily get into. But you know, until that work is done, I'm not going to feel satisfied that I've accomplished what I want to accomplish. If writing a book was easy and you could just like do it with a snap of your fingers, there's so many I would write. And what I'm thinking about a lot lately, I do not believe I will ever have time to do this, but if anybody wants to take on the challenge, I strongly recommend it. I want to teach people programming concepts for non-programmers, mm-hmm. and not like learning to code, and not like someone who wants to learn about algorithms, but rather there's a certain like mental toolkit, a certain way of looking at the world, a certain way of solving problems that computer scientists have that I think should be as common in the kind of educational literacy as like understanding the work of you know, historians or literary critics. Should be as well known as the scientific method. And I don't see people have it. There's a certain like rigor, a certain understanding that every problem that you face, there's like the particular problem that you face, but there's also that this problem is an instance, an example of a more abstract class of similar problems. And so the solution to this problem, you can just solve it and be done. Or you can be like, well, what class of problems is it? Like, are there well-known solutions to it? That like general move of being able to see the abstraction, reason about its performance, it's the like that, the kind of the systems thinking of it. I have found that so useful in my life in so many situations, from the like absurd, you know, like going to the grocery store and like looking at how they handle the like checkout registers and being like, this isn't the optimal flow. You know, to the like really profound, obviously, in my own work as a manager, as a founder. And I just think that for a lay audience, like the more and more I work with non-technical people, the more I'm like, God, I really think that if you had this toolkit, it would make your life better.
Awesome. With that, we're going to start this Meerkat AMA.
All right.
We were talking earlier about kind of this concept of lean startup in the enterprise.
Yeah.
What does it mean, or you know, what are you most excited about in the concept of MVP or lean startup among really big companies? And if big companies figure it out, what happens to startups then? You know, or how do you think about that?
Look, startups and big companies compete all the time, and today startups have a built-in advantage because so many big companies are like dumb bureaucratic political messes. Let's just be honest. So on the one hand, like, hey, that's good for startups. It's free money for me and my friends. But I think if everybody ups their game, it's better for everybody. So I think that, you know, it's basically a crime that so many companies, when they're doing new products and new initiatives, are wasting so much of people's time. I mean, it just makes me sick to think about. It's just like, visualize if you can with me the number of people who go into a job every single day and they don't know if the work they did that day matters to anybody. Like, I think when people look back on our time from the future, they're going to think this is like, you know, it's not slavery abhorrent, but it's pretty bad. people have the right to know that the work that they do matters. It creates value for customers, that they know that it serves some purpose. And yet most people don't have that feeling in their work today. And that's why I, you know, people always ask me in Silicon Valley, why are you wasting your time with these big dumb companies? But that's why. You know, the vast majority of people in the world still today work in some kind of established organization of size. And their creativity and innovation is being hampered by these really badly designed systems. And, you know, I used to have this kind of question, which is there anything you can do about that? Is that an inevitable part of being a big company? Is that just kind of a fact of life? And listen, in Silicon Valley, I still talk to investors and prominent people here. Just they're very resigned to it. They say, look, they can't do anything about that. The best thing you can do is squeeze all the value out of the company before it goes public. You know, once you become big, it's too late. But I've now seen it firsthand. I've seen companies adopt the transformation, change the way that they work, adopt these ideas. And what gets me excited about it is not just the financial performance of it, but that you see it in the faces of the people who get to work in a new way. The level of excitement and enthusiasm they have, the sense of relief that they have, that they know that their work matters, the chance to do the things they've always known the company should do but can never quite get implemented. Like, that's exciting.
We have a question from Danny. Does getting funding prove to be detrimental to the company? Or maybe we rephrase that question.
Yeah, well, certainly having too much funding can be lethal. We all know those, you know, like, you know those stories you read them about in TechCrunch, and it's like mega hyped monster raise on day one for an idea with a business plan. And like, usually you're like checking 18 months later, you're like, hey, whatever happened to that company? We're changing the world and killing it, and what happened? And when you go behind the scenes of those stories, sometimes, not every time, but sometimes people go, they just go nuts. They have too much money, and they start throwing it around like crazy, and they use money to solve problems they don't even have, and it gets ugly. But some people have interpreted Lean Startup to be anti-VC or anti-raising money. I'm not. I think there's a huge class of problems that are expensive to solve and that require outside investment. I think that's not a problem. I think what happens, though, is when you take outside funding, you and your new board of investors have to come up with an accountability system for the company to say, what does it mean to make progress by milestone? And most entrepreneurs don't have this conversation explicitly with their funders, and they wind up locked into a really bad accountability system based on vanity metrics and success theater. And that's what winds up killing companies. The companies that succeed, I think, are the ones that can really get clear about what does success look like and how do we know that we're making progress towards that success. And there's kind of a technical conversation about, like, what are the specific metrics and the accounting systems you should use to make that happen. But putting that aside, the real issue is just, like, how do we hold people accountable?
Devo asks, what companies have adopted this scale? And I think means, you know, what companies were small and using Lean Startup and then became big and now have had to, you know, think about.
Sure. I mean, I usually let companies speak for themselves. I don't like to be that religious figure that's like, you know, blessing this person's an official Lean Startup and this person isn't. When I published the Lean Startup in 2011, by far the biggest company that had like explicitly adopted it as a good idea was Intuit. And they are great. I'm a big Intuit fan. They had probably 8,000 employees plus or minus at the time, which for me was like impossibly large company adopting these ideas and was very scary and difficult and confusing. What's happened since then is that now, like, among kind of Lean Startup in the enterprise deployments, like, that's one of the smaller examples. We now have examples of people with tens of thousands and even hundreds of thousands of employees adopting it. You know, the biggest company that has been the most public lately about their implementation is GE. I've done a huge amount of work with them over the last 2 or 3 years. We have trained thousands of their top managers, all of their divisional CEOs, you know, across their entire product portfolio. And what's cool about GE is that you name a business, they're in it. I mean, they're just in so many different businesses. It's a legacy of you know, the old Jack Welch system of being in a lot of businesses and being the best in those businesses. So healthcare, energy, finance, appliances, you name it. I've worked on projects across that whole company. And what's been very exciting about that project is, first of all, the results that it has driven. They have made a conscious decision from the CEO on down to adopt these ideas in everything that they do, not just in new products, but also in new internal initiatives. So I've spent just as much time with sales, marketing, IT, finance, legal, you name it. And that's to see these ideas adopted at that kind of a scale with these kind of results is pretty cool.
Jared Janes is a great question. He asks, on the future of business, do you see efficiency leading to less average hours spent at work?
I mean, this is a deep question. Ever since John Maynard Keynes said that we were all going to be working 10 hours a week and having more time for philosophy, and it hasn't quite worked out the way that he said. But I think there was something right about what he was saying. I think that if we're being really honest with ourselves, a lot of the employment problems that we have today have to do with the fact that we've gotten so good at producing the basic necessities that we have excess capacity. We have no more productive capacity than we know what to do with. And that means that the fact that we have a lot of people who want to work and who can't, and the fact that we have a lot of people who are working more hours than they really ultimately would like to, that those are basically political questions. And not to mention the fact that there are a lot of people on this earth who don't have enough stuff. But for the first time in history, people are poor, people are starving, not because there's not enough stuff available, but because we haven't figured out how to produce and distribute it to them. So again, a political question. There's a great chart that's been making the rounds on social media lately that shows productivity growth and average worker wage growth, you know, by year over the past 100 years. And you can just see that it used to be that those two numbers would rise in lockstep. It's actually kind of spooky how similar they were. And then all of a sudden in a certain year, and I'll let you guess which year it was, or go look up the chart, they diverge. And productivity growth continues, but wage growth flatlines. I really don't believe the evidence is that anything technical happened in that year. It was a political change in the way that we in America especially thought about how people should be compensated. Unless we undo that, we're going to have this problem of, you know, basically inefficient allocation of labor to the people that want to do it. And I think eventually we will come to a more enlightened point of view when we say everybody who wants to work should, and nobody should be working crazy hours unless they really, 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 really want to.
How do you think about lean startup in the context of something like, you know, government or politics or governmental organizations, and if there is a role for it, and how do, when you come across these kind of questions that are political in nature, how do you think about them?
Yeah, there's two areas that this is being very actively worked on right now. One is what is traditionally called lean government. First time someone was like, what do you think about lean government? I was like, give me a break. Is that a contradiction in terms? I was very skeptical. But we now have really good examples of people inside the federal government in the United States, as well as in the UK government, and a number of municipal governments taking these lean startup ideas, building internal startups that are designed to serve constituents in a better way and succeeding. So I'm a big believer now in this. And for those that are interested, if you've never heard of the United States Digital Service, USDS, like, hit them up on Twitter, go check it out. There's some very cool stuff happening. What's interesting about lean government is it happens mostly behind the scenes in the implementation of government. So it's kind of boring. It doesn't make it onto the cable news channels. It's not a right-left fight. It's something that both makes government more efficient and therefore smaller, but also delivers more services to people. So it's like, is that a liberal or a conservative thing? Well, yes. Now, that's lean government. There's also an even more recent phenomenon of people starting to ask the question, what would happen if we applied lean startup to campaigns? Not just to the mechanism of government, but to these massive startups that get built every 4 years, to build a presidential campaign from scratch, to win an election and then disband. You know, it has a very startup flavor to it. And as people start to understand that big data and kind of analytics and iteration are critical to the winning of campaigns, people are starting to think about, hey, are there some ideas that could be imported from lean startup into these things? So that's a much more avant-garde area, but I think a very fruitful one.
Are there certain governments that are very lean, you know, outside of the US, or governments that you see as adopting the principles very well?
Well, this is very early, so I wouldn't call any government lean at this stage. What we have are promising examples of, you know, the beginnings of that transformation happening. Like, and again, you got to think, like, the miracle is not that it happens at all. You know, it's like there's some old joke about the talking dog. It's like, or the singing dog. It's like, not that what matters is not like how smart is what he has to say. It's like, what matters is, you're like, oh my god, it's a talking dog. Right. Like, that's to me why you know, why I'm so excited about lean government. You know, I've been talking about the United States Digital Service. It's called the United States Digital Service based on something that was done in the UK government called the UK Digital Service, that I think was the first to kind of say, hey, the way that we deliver and procure IT services in the government should change and should adopt these ideas. And like, they have a manifesto, the USDS has a manifesto. There's a group in the US called 18F, as well as a nonprofit group called Code for America. that all of whom have kind of put out white papers and manifestos of various kinds. And if you go read what they're advocating, you'll be like, hey, this sounds very familiar. That sounds a lot like Lean Startup.
Yeah. What are the biggest concerns you have going forward, or if there are any, in terms of, you know, maybe unemployment, for example, just as technology becomes more, you know, pervasive? It's kind of like a very broad question.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But what do you think about?
I don't have anything special to add. People, if people don't really know what the major problems facing our world are, then like they're not really paying sufficient attention from my point of view. Obviously, climate change. Obviously, like I was talking about before, the disparities between people, the unrest and the political tension that inevitably gives rise to. I think it's very short-sighted for those of us in the wealthier parts of the world to think that we can compartmentalize ourselves away from those problems when we have the resources and the infrastructure to solve them once and for all if we want to. So it's both ethically and politically short-sighted, I think, not to solve those problems. I don't worry about the AI apocalypse, you know, the singularity, all that kind of stuff. It's not that I don't think it's not going to happen, but I think that we have such a little understanding of what that level of technological sophistication is. Like, I've noticed that a lot of the people who are most worried about the AI apocalypse don't really have a good understanding of how software is built and just how freaking hard it is. So, like, I don't believe we're nearly as close to those events as the people who are worried about it think. Not that I don't think it's worthy of study and worthy of investigation, but I think we have much more pressing and more immediate problems. And maybe I'll throw in a plug for Lawrence Lessig's campaign to end corruption in the United States. That is such a big deal and so far has gone so poorly. But I am a believer that as he pivots and as he figures out, hey, how do we make this happen? I think that is a reform that ultimately will have a very big impact.
Yeah. And maybe we can help support it on product on somehow as it...
Hey, that actually would be super cool.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to take one more question.
Make it count.
Yeah. After this, Jess had one, and then we'll take one more. So ask them. But this one by Jess was, are you excited about VR? What do you think about it? Where are we?
Yeah. First of all, I have not tried Oculus Rift or any of these new generation VR experiences, which I am told, and I believe, like, there's something truly breakthrough about the level of suspension of disbelief that they can create. So I'm very excited about the technological breakthrough there. I think that something is super cool is about to happen because we have that, you know, for things like training simulations. And but having spent a lot of time in the virtual world space and avatars and fought with the Uncanny Valley for many years, like, the gap between that technological breakthrough and truly social connective experiences there, I'm not yet seeing much evidence that we are ready to make progress there. So I think mainstream VR as a social or consumer product, I think, is still quite a ways off. I think we may look back on this phase as like the 3D television phase of VR. People are very excited about something because it can be done without asking the question of, you know, what is it for? But on the other hand, think about like the new problem we're about to have of too many drones and who the hell is going to pilot these drones. And you're like, gosh, wouldn't it be handy to be able to put on a VR helmet and go see what your drone is doing and have a full immersive view of the world from your drone's point of view? Like, I think there are all kinds of really important commercial applications of these technologies that we're not currently, at least I'm not seeing a lot of people talk about, but I think are going to be awfully cool. The other thing I'll say is, if you're investing in VR technology but you're not investing in avatar technology and you're on the social consumer side, you really don't understand what is required to create what an interviewee used to call personalized anonymity. The amazing thing about an avatar is it is both a more intimate reflection of your true self, if it's done right, and also a completely anonymous reflection of yourself. Like, your body is not involved. You can hide behind a pseudonym or a completely fabricated creation, and yet when you have the right technology for avatars, you can make them emotionally expressive in a way that, you know, video chat never can be, in a way that most video games simply don't invest in. So I think that as we do more AR and VR, avatars are going to be a more important core technology, and I don't really see anybody working on that. So they should probably buy in view because we spent a lot of time thinking about that.
Cool. I didn't see any other questions, so I'll ask the last one. In today's world, let's say you were 10 years, you were 26, what would you tell yourself?
I've been asked variations of this question before, and I have a confession to make. I have a problem with it. I was a very arrogant kid. I thought I knew fucking everything. And so if my older self had come back from the future to give me some advice, like what I fear is that I wouldn't have listened to a word of it. So I think about this a lot. Like what would I have had to say to that younger self that he would actually take seriously? And, you know, like I think if I tried to explain to him how business works, how startups work, he didn't want to hear about that. He wasn't interested. He thought he knew everything about it. He's seen it on TV. You know, he knew too much. Maybe not at 26, but when I was a little bit younger. But I guess what I really would want to tell him is it's going to work out okay. You know, like I had so much anxiety and so much like worry, like am I ever going to amount to anything? Is my career going to matter? If I ever have a startup that will succeed? And I wasted a lot of time and energy worrying about that kind of stuff instead of doing the actual work that would make it happen. And so I just wish I could go back to my younger self and say, hey, listen, relax. You know, learn to manage yourself, learn to manage your emotions and your stress proactively so that you can do better work. But like have faith that it, like if you do good work, good things will follow. That's certainly been my experience.
A great note to end on. Everybody, thank you for your questions. Thank you for listening. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Eric. Have a great day. See you guys later.